Joe, we're how you doing? We're back for what, our 61st episode, I believe. I have that right?
Isn't it something how time flies, you know, when you're having fun? Hopefully this is just the beginning of 6,000 of our shows. Or maybe 666, perhaps, would be another number of miles. Yeah, something along. But, one thing that we haven't covered yet is the phenomenon of the serial killer, that important. I mean, how can you ignore them? There's so many of them now in our culture. They pop up all the time. Sandy Hook, you know, the Harvest Festival in Las Vegas. You know, those are kind of mass murders where hundreds of people are killed purportedly. But it actually is part of this phenomena that has, you know, become kind of part of our culture, where, you know, a single individual will kill many others, usually for, obviously, for, you know, crazy reasons. So what do we know about the serial killer? I mean, what should we know about them?
Well, the serial killer, the specter of the serial killer became a common feature of American culture, the American landscape, probably in the post-war era, particularly after the 1950s. Now, the public's reaction to these characters, these creatures, it ranges from, you know, horror, revulsion, to sort of a morbid fascination. Of course, this is fed, or at least created, by the saturation coverage that's provided by the mainstream media, the press, movies, and Hollywood. Of course, much of what people see as a serial killer is probably a product of Hollywood, as in so much of their interpretation of reality, their understanding of reality. Nevertheless, it's become a prevalent feature in Western culture, particularly the United States. I think the United States hosts 76% of the world's known serial killers. Serial killer, let's go to Wikipedia again, I guess, for the explanation of what the serial killer is. According to Wikipedia, a serial killer is typically a person who murders three or more people, usually in service of an abnormal psychological gratification, with the murders taking place over more than a month, including a significant period of time between them. Different authorities apply different criteria when designated serial killers. While most set a threshold of three murders, others extend it to four or lessen it to two. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, for example, defines serial killing as a series of two or more murders committed as separate events, usually but not always as one offender acting alone. Although psychological gratification is the usual motive for serial killing, the most serial killings involve sexual contact with the victim. The FBI states that the motives of serial killers can include anger, thrill-seeking, financial gain, and attention-seeking. Murders may be attempted or completed in a similar fashion. The victims may have something in common, for example, demographic profile, appearance, gender, or race. The serial killer is neither a mass murderer or a spree killer, so the distinction they're making there. The English term and concept of serial killer are commonly attributed to a former FBI special agent, Robert Ressler, who used the term serial homicide in 1974 in a lecture at Bram's Hill Police Academy in Britain. Author Anne Rule postulates in her book Kiss Me, Kill Me that the English language credit for coining the term goes to the LAPD detective Pierce Brooks, who created the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program system in 1985. However, there is ample evidence that the term was used in Europe and the United States earlier. The German term and concept were coined by the influential Ernst Genet, who described Peter Curtin as a serial murderer. That's German, I guess. Serial murder. So the term kind of developed over the years. It became common, I guess, in the American language, the American lexicon, probably the late 70s or 80s. Particularly after the Atlanta child murders that have been attributed to Wayne Williams, who was convicted for those crimes in 1981. Let me see here. Now, of course, the FBI in 2005 hosted a multidisciplinary symposium in San Antonio, Texas, to bring together 135 experts unseal murder from a variety of fields and specialties. The goal was to identify the commonalities of knowledge regarding serial murder, but the group also settled on a definition of the crime, which FBI investigators widely accept as the standard. Serial murder is unlawful killing of two or more victims by the same offender or offenders in separate events. Now, probably most people's first idea of a serial killer is probably the Jack the Ripper case, an identified killer in the 1880s. And this is funny because this goes to maybe part of the serial killer phenomenon is media-driven. This was the first internationally known serial killer. Of course, happening in London, the heart of the British Empire, the capital of the British Empire. And that's also the, at the time, sort of the center of Western press and media as it existed at the time. So it got around the world, and this is the first time, I guess, with telegraph and these things that you had an idea of rapid communication. So these stories got out. So it had its cultural phenomenon with the serial killer. But then again, with the serial killer, particularly after the 1960s, because you had the Boston Strangler case, I think, from 1962 to 1964, that has been attributed to Albert DeSalvo, though he was not convicted for those crimes. Strange enough, his defense rested on the idea that he was indeed the Boston Strangler. F. Lee Bailey was his attorney. Although most people believe now he probably was only guilty of one, and he was maybe a copycat, and there are several of Boston Stranglers. Some people think completely unrelated, just various crimes that was kind of woven together by the police or by the media. Again, a question whether or not that actual serial killer ever actually existed. So there's a question of what is a serial killer? Is it this marauding individual out there lurking, waiting for his victims based on some sort of criteria he has? Is it, as some people postulated, perhaps a part of a psychological warfare operation, something on the lines of MKUltra? Or Phoenix program to apply domestically. We can get into that, how that theory may be legitimate. Or is it a kind of sort of a narrative that's spun? These serial killers sometimes are narratives that are created by media hysteria. So that's the question. So that's kind of like the synopsis of maybe the issues of what serial killer is as a phenomenon, as an actual physical manifestation. Also, how to understand the idea of the serial killer in our modern society. So what do you have to say to that, Joe?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to start with a digression. I hate when people do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, just because my little community of Montecito was, over the last couple days, subjected to an enormous police activity, which didn't come to the point of serial killing, but rumors circulated about this. And this is why I wanted to bring it up. So what happened was three black guys got off the freeway, which runs through Montecito, you know, heading toward L.A. We're about 100 miles north of L.A. And for some reason, they wanted to rob the place. And they went in. This is all purported, right? This is what's been said. So they went in and, you know, I mean, Montecito is like typical American upper class suburb. It's armed to the teeth, right? Just video cameras. I mean, it's virtually like a militia, you know. The guys come in and, you know, 911 gets called and there's a police response. So these three black guys, there's actually a gun battle. At least a cop fired a round and the three black guys ran out. Now, this is where it gets interesting because, and the reason I'm bringing it up is the rumors about what had happened just spread like wildfire. And there were helicopters and cops everywhere. And the first thing that was being spread, at least, you know, by in these phone trees, was that there were a number of fatalities, that there had been a serial murder. And so... the terror got into the community, and then everyone was on alert. I mean, you know, like one of my neighbors was out in his battle fatigue with his like AR, and he trained his kids to fire in like battalion formation.
I finally get to use this thing.
I mean, it was so preposterous, and anyway, so I think, when all is said and done, you know, there wasn't, I'm not even sure a single round was fired. It was all hysteria. They caught two of the guys. The third guy managed to escape, and this was when all the rumors were flying, you know, that he was Jack the Ripper in the community. But it's ended almost tragicomic. He was able to steal a car, and he was going to head south. Now, he would have zero chance of making it to L.A. where he came from, because obviously he's a black guy in a stolen car. I mean, they're going to pick you right up on, you know, on the freeway. But his nerves were shot, evidently, and he got in an accident as he was trying to get on the freeway on-ramp. And so that was the end of that. But the fact is that terror had spread, right? Fantasy had come in, and everyone basically, it was interesting, they were kind of all in conjunction with the police, and, you know, they were wondering, like, should we call in the militia, you know, or not, I mean, the National Guard. You know, they were just behaving like the Russians had landed on Santa Barbara Beach. You know, their thinking just went kaput. And I think that it's an important lesson, because the serial killer is, you know, gives the government the chance to basically wreck our capacity to think clearly. We become terrorized. And I'm sure we'll talk tonight at some point about the work of Dave McGowan, who talks about, you know, the programming of serial killers. This theory, which is very interesting. You know, I don't know if it's true, but it is logically consistent. I mean, in our show, we've talked so many times about how the government manipulates our capacity to think with fake narratives, right? But sometimes with actually the insertion of real events, like, for example, the actual destruction of the Twin Towers and Building 7. I mean, we can discuss how they were actually destroyed, but the fact is they were destroyed. People were actually killed. And this was, you know, in my mind, it's just very clear this was what I would call a fictional narrative. I mean, some of the events were real enough, but as it was, the media was presented to us, it was to basically create the greatest amount of terror that they were able to, so that the wars in the Middle East would have some kind of psychological justification. And other reasons, probably symbolic, or, you know, reasons that the secret society has, which we're not aware of. So this is the first thing that I think, you know, the material that we've been bringing out in our shows, the context that it creates, hopefully enables our listeners to have this kind of more distant and more objective perspective about serial killing, is that the first question you have to ask is, is this just a narrative that people are creating for the purpose of cultural debasement, right? Mm-hmm. When the citizens are terrorized, then they will put up with, you know, basically a more slave state government, right? Because they're looking to the government for, you know, help us with the zombies, the commies, the serial killers, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just wanted to, you know, conclude this little opening rant with, I'm going to point out that Jack the Ripper was really the very first kind of media serial killer star, right? I mean, he was those murders were, like you said in the intro, that the media had developed enough so that you could use it to create terror. And, you know, I think then you go to things like, you know, the War of the Worlds broadcast, right? And you can see that, you know, there in that instance, that the government was caught red-handed trying to do an experiment to see, you know, how terror might spread using the media. The case with Jack the Ripper, which was, he was the first, you know, serial killer superstar, to coin an expression. This wasn't as clear cut as some of the ones, you know, I just mentioned, but I'm sure it was basically an experiment. And the reason why I'm so sure about this is that if you look at the way that Charles Warren participated in the Jack the Ripper media story, you can see that he really was not just behind the scenes, but even overtly, he was the guy who was running basically the media. Now, Charles Warren, we've talked about him many times. We talked about him last week when you know, we mentioned that in the Boer Wars, he was there. He was one of the generals. He was helping to set up the original concentration camps, right? Now, and his lodge had been brought down into South Africa, the Quattro Coronati, which we have documented as having so many connections into the creations of both Zionism and the Nazi Party, right? So Warren is a critical figure from the perspective of creating fake narratives, right, and real, historical destruction. But the fact that he was completely involved and often can be seen as the person who's controlling the media representation of how Jack the Ripper is being presented, I think shows just without a shadow of a doubt, once we've identified him as, you know, being part of the Quattro Coronati operation to create Zionism and the Nazi Party and to set up the creation of the State of Israel and the destruction of the Europeans using World War II, once you can show him so clearly, you know, all of the details that we've shown that in past shows that demonstrate this, then the fact that he was involved with the Jack the Ripper thing, I think identifies it, you know, or suggests that this is something that was being done for the purpose of culture pollution, right? So it was creating terror. Terror makes people more relying on the government. And I'll just give you a really interesting example of the control that that he used over the investigation. There was a statement that was written on the wall supposedly by the Ripper. It was copied by one individual, and as it turned out, there was basically some confusion about what was actually written. But the letters, the writing itself will never be known, because Warren made an executive decision on the spot to have it erased, to take it down. He said that it was too dangerous. Now, what he was trying to prevent purportedly was a flare-up of anti-Semitism, because what the statement said. But anyway, there are three different versions of it, and I want to give them, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because I think that this is, you can see that, well, in my opinion, the three statements are actually a logic puzzle. And I'm not going to go into it because it'll bore the listeners. But I think that those of them who are curious about it, email me and we can go through it. But the three statements were, this is supposedly written by the Ripper at the site of one of the murders of the women. And one of the version was, the Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. You know, notice the double negatives, you know, creating a logic issue. But that was contested by another individual who said, no, the statement was, the Jews are not the men who will be blamed for nothing. And then finally, and now, incidentally, the word Jew, according to the first two, was spelled J-U-W-E-S. That's an important thing. And the final one was the one, which is the one that Warren's office came up with as a statement, is the Jews, and in this case it was spelled J-E-W-E-S, are not the men to be blamed for nothing. Okay, so you have Jews, J-U-W-E-S, and then the final one is J-E-W. Okay, so now this is very Masonic, because in the killing of Hiram Abiff, the group that killed him are referred to as the Jews, J-U-W-E-S. That's how Freemason refers to them, because the three people in there, Jubella, Jubello, and Jubellum. And believe me, you know, as in so much of Masonry and in the historical, you know, religious texts we have, like the New Testament and this is actually a little puzzle. The oligarchs are here with Jubella, Jubello, and Jubellum. It's, you know, there's actually meaning there. And so when you get into Warren's, you know, changing of this to the Jews, well, I mean, it, you know, it's obviously the fact that the first two were claiming J-U-W-E-S. This is obviously Masonic. And the way that the bodies were cut up is also Masonic. The most obvious one is that in one case, the intestines were thrown over the shoulder. And that is actually an image in one of the Masonic rites or initiation levels. Now, the only other thing that I just wanted to mention because I think this will amuse those of us who the date of one of the murders was on a date of the Quattro Coronati's initiation of ceremonies. So people have wondered about that. And so you can see that, okay, so let's just take for the sake of argument, Tim, that this is a Masonic, you know, project, right? This is, and Warren is being put there as in charge of the London's police department to oversee it, make sure it goes as they want it. I think there, what you have with the very first of the serial killers is basically kind of a 911. I mean, there's no doubt that the bodies are real. It's horrifying. But the kind of the narrative about, well, who this individual is and what could the motivations be, that's all hidden. I mean, basically, that's all just being presented, you know, as a way to just scare the population. And then inside the thing, you can see symbolism. I think we probably get into like the Son of Sam. I mean, he's like an OTO kind of cutout. And that's a serial killer that also has some kind of connections into, you know, Masonic symbolism. So like with 911. And so basically, this is my take, Tim, is that, you know, you have real serial killers. I think they're very, very rare, but I think they do exist. The media uses them as whenever they are fortunate enough to have a real serial killer come into a mist, they give it 100 times more publicity than the events would really deserve, but they do that to degrade our culture. But then in addition to that, you have, you know, the basically the Masonic crypto secret society probably faking a lot of this stuff. You know, like you look at Sandy Hook, which is not necessarily a serial killing, but by some definitions can be seen as such. You know, and then there are people saying, well, where is it? You know, they go and they do research and they find, you know, there are all these inconsistencies, and it looks more like a media terrorist creating event than anything else. And then finally, I'll just point out that where the serial killing really takes place is inside our media. I mean, it's in the movies. I mean, there, you know, you get the psychopath murdering people one after another after another. It's just a common character in our polluted media. And in the same way that the, you know, the historical narrative of a real serial killer is being, you know, given to us to terrorize us, to damage our mind, to keep us from thinking clearly, to want government. In the media, it's just self-evident to me that that's why the serial killer is such a, you know, a common genre that we have to put up with.
Yeah, it's to the extent that we have to ask ourselves, are these figures actually real? Of course, there are some real, you know, characters, you know, Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer. So, you know, real people, Dennis Rader. But you have to ask yourselves, the stories that we hear about them, how accurate are they? Is the body count exaggerated? Are the stories, you know, exaggerated or embellished to provide more of a gore factor in these things, particularly some character like Jeffrey Dahmer or something? If you're simply going to rely on the media for the details, then unfortunately they're really not a reliable source. I alluded to it, at least I've referred to it in the intros, you know, the Boston Strangler, which you know, now it's you know, Abel DeSalvo, I think that he's been genetically linked to at least one of the crimes, to the extent that you can trust, you know, DNA evidence. But again, people don't realize that, yeah, he's called the Boston Strangler, but he wasn't convicted of on that. He was convicted as a serial rapist and a thief. also the case of the one of the early cases of the Zodiac killer out in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 60s and early 70s. How I've done a couple of interviews with Thomas Horan, a media professor, and he's written a series of books on that case, and I think he's provided a lot of evidence to suggest the whole thing was a hoax, product of local police, corrupt police, just trying to close the books, sensationalist media, particularly the San Francisco Chronicle, just got some phony letters, and they linked together these crimes that were otherwise unlinked. But nevertheless, the Zodiac killer mythos was created, or the character was created, through this narrative in the minds of the public, and that sort of degrading effect had on society, spreading of fear, so much so that some people are fans of the Zodiac in a perverse sense. Yeah. And so when they come across evidence that's suggesting that maybe the whole thing was a hoax, they react very, they don't like that because their anti-hero has been, their villain has been destroyed. But the whole idea that a sort of a literary figure, a narrative could be spun to create something that never really, someone that never really existed is, have to tell, you know, create sort of, I guess, epistemological questions for ourselves. If we rely on our view of the world through the media, through electronic media, then we're not going to have a very firm grasp on reality. We're not going to be on firm ground when it comes to the evidence, because obviously when you have a media that's newspapers that are hungry to increase circulation, you have local police perhaps that are anxious to close the books on some of these crimes. At the same time, you have police who give interviews like there were no ties between the murders in the Bay Area. They don't get the press because it doesn't serve the narrative. But then again, the Zodiac killer exists in the imagination of the American people. So in a sense, he does exist because it has the effect. The question of, you're familiar with Dave McGowan's book, Program to Kill. And he offered a number of observations regarding the purpose of the serial killer. And other than being, again, this sort of this marauding individual, sort of a creation of our troubled society, he suggested that perhaps the serial killers have a connection to things like organized crime, the mafia, even the intelligence agencies, as sort of a strategy of tension, and also a murder incorporated. These are contract killers that can be used from time to time, sort of like how the intelligence agencies would use cults to carry out some of their operations, whether it's drug running or human trafficking and these things. Now, the evidence he provided for this theory is the fact that many of these serial killers have ties to the government, police, or the military. Now, as you ask yourselves what creates a serial killer, some people have pointed out that, we can have more of them now because we have such a larger military establishment. And of course, you also had various wars, and people go to war. And one thing the military does when it trains people in boot camp is it trains them to lose their inhibition about killing. And you can't train that many people, particularly young men, about killing, send them off to battle somewhere, have them come back, and expect them just to turn that off and become, normal participants or just normal average day civilians. A large percentage of them aren't going to adjust well, and they perhaps become these serial killers. You also have a sinister and deliberate policy that program that's suggested by these serial killers is the serial killers were a form of a Phoenix program applied domestically, and at least chronologically it seems to work out that way, because just when the Vietnam War was kind of shutting down, you had the rise of the serial killer back home. And of course, the person who ran the Phoenix program in Vietnam was Bill Colby, and he came back in the early 70s, and that's when you sort of had this phenomenon kick in. The question of, was this an attempt to sort of, as you say, sort of terrorize society, create an atomization of society, so society, communities don't cohere, kids don't go out and play anymore, and you can have this sort of a chemical effect on society just through the suggestion, the narrative. You can have a case, you can have one case of a serial killer gets in the media and it magnifies it by several orders of magnitude because now it's in the media and create the false impression that the community out there, the outside world, is filled with, you know, all types of threats to you know, to children and women and these things, and it has had therefore it has this sort of atomizing effect. Another theory was that from time to time these serial killers will be used as sort of a contract killer, and they can go out and they can they're sort of identified through the psychiatric institutions. And they may even be in prison for a decade or so, then inexplicably released. And then they'll go out and they'll commit these crimes, but in between these crimes, in between, interspersed in some of these murders, is an actual target. And that's some of the that's one theory applied to a character like Henry Lee Lucas, who claimed thousands of victims. He's been tied to hundreds. Some people think he's probably, quote, only responsible for perhaps a dozen. He bragged about some of these murders so much so it's hard to believe him, because, again, he was also a pathological liar. But nevertheless, he did claim that he was part of this Hand of God cult, which had ties to the intelligence community, and he claimed that there was a ranch called Rancho Diablo, I think, where bodies were buried. Subsequently, bodies were found, and he was operating near the Texas border in these things. And he also teamed up with one Otis Toole. Interestingly enough, Otis Toole operated primarily in Florida, I believe, but he claimed he traveled around with Henry Lucas killing, doing these murders, picking up hitchhikers. Who's to say? But one thing Henry Lucas did was he made all these claims, and various police departments kind of would pick him up and drive him around the various crime scenes, and he'd say, yeah, I did that one, and they'd close their books without any evidence. And of course, at the whole time, they're feeding him and, you know, treating him. Eventually he gets on death row in Texas for a murder, which then is granted clemency by George W. Bush, the governor, in the late 90s, inexplicably, claiming that somehow the actual case he was convicted for, he was probably not guilty of, despite the fact he was guilty of several other murders. George Bush gives him clemency, and he dies in prison. The same thing occurred to Otis Toole, his partner in crime for a while. Otis Toole was, I believe, granted clemency by George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, from Florida. He died in prison as well, and he subsequently was, he confessed to, and then he recanted, I believe, but the Hollywood police, Hollywood, Florida police, eventually came out and said he was the one who murdered Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh was the six-year-old boy who was kidnapped out of a Sears department store in 1981, disappeared, and they found his head floating in the canal. It became a sort of this, one of these national cases. I think you and I probably both remember that. I remember it. You probably remember it. His father, John Walsh, went on to host America's Most Wanted and these shows. But it was a tragic case, a terrible story, and it sort of traumatized the country. But again, in all these cases, you have sort of the common link of inexplicable police incompetence, people being released out of prison early so they can go on and kill more, and then they're finally caught. And so it's really confusing, but none of it seems to make any sense. But if you look at it from the theory that Dave McGowan was proposing, it does make make some sense to it, that it's a form of sort of a murder incorporated, contract killing, psychological warfare. Now, you think this is amazing, or you're incredulous. People hear this, well, I mean, how would this work? Who would implement this program? How would this ever operate? And first of all, who would do such a thing? Well, when I said it was the domestic application of the Phoenix program, if you look what the Phoenix program was involved with in Vietnam, and also what various death squad operations, they were supported by the School of the Americas, the U.S. Defense Department, the CIA. These programs were designed to hire, they would find ruthless, savage killers, train them, and use them for military and intelligence operations in these various troubled spots or dirty wars, Central America or Southeast Asia and these things. The Phoenix program, it was a counter terrorist or a counter operation in South Vietnam. It was designed to target what was called the Viet Cong civilian infrastructure. Now, what that means was, since the Viet Cong were supported by, were guerrilla warfare, supported by living off the land, supported by the by the people in the area, it means that basically it was a declaration of war on Vietnamese civilians. And part of the operation was psychological warfare, or psychological operation, was to occasionally go into villages and wipe out the families of suspected Viet Cong fighters. And this involved the gruesome killing, beheading, disembowelment, the display of the bodies. And of course, men would have to be trained to do this. They have to be, you know, able to do these things, have the psychological makeup that enables them to do these things and go home and sleep at night. Well, when the Vietnam War shuts down, these men come home. What are they going to do for a living? How are they going to conduct themselves in society? So you can make the case that maybe perhaps this was weaponized and applied domestically. Now, how it's going to be applied domestically is going to be very differently how it's applied in like a country like Vietnam. If you want to spread fear in the United States and upset people's sense of security, this is precisely what you'd want to do. And the people who study mass psychology, society, these things, the intelligence agencies, the think tanks, employ experts in these things, know how to manipulate these things. We call it weaponized anthropology. And, of course, that has a long history with the CIA, people like Gregory Bateson, how you identify certain aspects of a culture, its weaknesses and strengths, its superstitions, its anxieties, and you exploit it. What a way to exploit American society by undermining their sense of security. And that's the theory behind that. One of the theories behind the serial killer phenomenon.
Yeah. Well said. I think that we always have to remember we're in the post 9/11 world. You know, you were talking about who would do such a thing? You know, this the fact that the public is incredulous concerning the possibility that this might be organized by some government agency or some society that is outside of government. That's ridiculous. We're post 9/11, right? The government murders us. You know, they manipulate the press after having pulled off the lamest false flag probably in history, with so many blunders, and you know, from the BBC presenter talking about Building 7 falling down while it's still standing in back of her, you know, to so many ways that the thing is. The story about the box cutters, you know, I mean, look, when you look at something like the serial killer, the first way to try to understand it is it's propaganda. That's the very first way, because it has such a powerful cultural impact. Mm-hmm. You can never analytically go, I will just assume it's true because, you know, Fox News is reporting that there's a serial killer loose in my neighborhood, you know. You just can't do that. It's just ridiculous. So 2 weeks ago, you said something I thought was so important. You know, you said that, well, you know, giving the aspects of what the secret society does enables us to possibly see history at our world as it would be without that force. And the fact is, so many of the really horrific elements inside our culture would simply disappear because they're artificially constructed. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's something that people should always remember, is that when we try to get rid of the secret society, we're really trying to make not just a peaceful, but a world that's fun and righteous to live in. And so with the serial killer, there is obviously from time to time, I think, real individuals who are simply insane, mm-hmm. but are not so insane that they can't use a weapon or stay out of the reach of police for, you know, a few episodes. And so the fact is that there probably are real serial killers, right? Probably a real thing. There is no way for us to look through the media to the actual events and then know the truth. It's just not possible. You know, you can't go to Hannity or to, you know, Wolf Blitzer and ask them to tell you what happened. They will always lie. They will always use events as propaganda. And so since, you know, the we don't have a media developed by the citizenry that it gives it the most honest representation. You know, when you look at something like the serial killer, you just have to look in and see if there are elements that link to the secret society, that, like I was, you know, alluding to with Jack the Ripper, mm-hmm. the original one. And this shows you that, okay, we can see that the secret society is there. It's present, obviously, with Charles Warren and all the Masonic elements of the Ripper, you know, murders. They are there inside this thing. Obviously, it's part of what's leading up to World War II, right? It's the terrorism of the population is really valuable to keep the public wanting a police state, you know, wanting more police, wanting more government. So you have to, you know, terror is such a, you know, it's like pornography. It's just this really valuable tool for the secret society to manipulate us with. There they are. Warren is leading the investigation. We don't need to really go any further analytically. We know that, hey, it's just a propaganda device. The Ripper, you know, just because of the nature of the murders, I think it's impossible to think that was the Masonic aspects of them are just circumstantial. No, they are committing the murders just like the people who died in 9/11. Okay, so we have, so that this is actually sunshine. Here we are, because we can now clearly see that the vast majority of the serial killers are not real. The violence that they try to sell us is crazed violence, right? Just, you know, the individual has lost control of themselves, and there are just these bizarre psychological and inexplicable reasons for the person to want to go around and kill everyone. But when you start looking into these, to the people who are given to us serial killers, you can see, just like with Ripper, you can see so many connections into these either government intelligence, to the military, and to the, you know, Masonic world. And so what this tells us is that the serial killer as a just sort of an aspect of human nature, right? That just sort of is like one out of every 100 of us is going to be a serial killer. That this is just nonsense. That if we have that kind of fear about the serial killer, that we have been manipulated. And basically we have lost part of our humanity because, you know, we are responding with fear instead of reason. The right approach with the serial killer is to, you know, as with so many things, is to try to see how it might be coming from the secret society. That's the real important way to deal with, you know, with like the serial killers, and also with all mass shootings, you know, which are, as I said, by one definition, serial killing.
Yeah, it's almost like the mass shooter has taken the place of the serial killer, the mass right. shooter, yeah.
Well, that's right, because I think they need to ratchet up the terror a little bit, you know, as we head toward the slave state, just so that we really need government dramatically. You know, it's like I'm pretty sure you're going to see, you know, really large scale terrorism before the police state onsets. So that,
yeah, because what happens is the media gets a hold of it, and you might even have some genuine copycats out there doing this, and that it's part of the plan. Where it's sensationalized in the media, and then they should have made celebrities out of this sort of lampooned, or the message that's sent in the movie, Natural Born Killers.
Natural Born Killers. Yeah. Great example, because look at that. Why would such a sick and debased story be created into a movie? Mm-hmm. What is the point of this? I mean, almost all of the cesspool Quentin Tarantino's, you know, disgusting movies, you look at them, you go, well, why would even, you know, why would, I mean, what would someone even want to bring such a story to the public for? I mean, why would this even be something that, you know, would even catch your attention? Well, it's obvious. It's just there as part of the, you know, mayhem is also, you know, like terror. Mayhem creates violence from people. Mayhem creates terror. I mean, these are the emotions that secret society spooks like Quentin Tarantino and basically the whole directorial cast. I mean, he's the one I'm pointing out because he's the most obvious, but you know, Hollywood is a cesspool.
Yeah, it creates what? Fear, apathy, and paralysis.
Well, and also mayhem. I mean, with, you know, like I heard Quentin, he was saying, well, you know, yeah, there's a lot of black and white killing in Django, but it's cathartic. Right, it's cathartic. I don't think so. I think it's stimulating. I think that that's the whole purpose of it. It's the idea is he's trying to create interracial violence, right? That's the whole purpose of the movie, is to try to plug that in to see if he can stimulate it. Now,
it's revenge porn. Same thing with
exactly
with, the what's that World War II movie he did?
Glorious Bastards.
Inglorious Bastards. Yeah.
Yeah. So in other words, you know, the vengeance that it becomes mayhem is an ideal process for the secret society. It's just clearly being injected into our culture all the time as a way to create debased thinking citizens. You know, once, and just think about that. I mean, you know, once those emotions are in you, how do you get rid of them? How do you actually transition from watching Pulp Fiction to being able to think clearly about the culture that you're actually living in?
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard. And so this is why you really shouldn't ever expose yourself to this garbage. You know, just don't watch it on TV. Don't go to the theaters. Try to convince other people to boycott Hollywood, boycott the media, boycott these films, sequester the weaponized anthropology by not participating in it. And with the serial killer, I mean, you know, when these individuals come forward, you know, Son of Sam, the Zodiac, rather than just numbly sit there and ingest the media's vomit, try to keep yourselves analytically buoyant, right? Try to always look. Try to look in back to see. Well, what was this individual's connections, and is he real? First of all, you know, like in the Zodiac, who knows if there was even the individual existed? But you have the news story. You know, or you can strongly suspect that it's there as weaponized anthropology. So, in order to prevent it from damaging you, go immediately into analysis. Try to see, well, what is the reality of this individual? And when you can come up with, for example, like, you know, the obvious weaknesses in the storyline of Jack the Ripper as just, you know, a lone, crazy person, when you can show all these Masonic elements, then this should be an aspect of what, that should be what you're trying to talk to other people about. You know, that's the, it goes into the, you know, I've mentioned a number of times that the best way to rebel is by being brave in conversation with people, right? That's the very best way. That's the way we can take a first step of spreading awareness of the secret society and the cultural anthropology, the weaponized cultural anthropology, get it out in the open so people can talk about these things, right? They're not intimidated about it. Well, this is just another example. This should, instead of just you know, around the water cooler at business being terrorized by the latest mass shooting or serial murder, try to find out about the individual, about the event, and bring those questions as, is this real? You know, are we being manipulated? Instead of being terrorized, ask the question, are we being manipulated? And if we are, let's go through the process and try to get to the bottom of it. Get the public, get your friends, get yourself thinking in that way about these events. I think that's really the best response to, you know, the serial killer and to the mass murder. And believe me, Tim, as I see our, you know, as I see how things are going, there's going to be more and more of them as they try to make us, you know, want more and more government.
Yeah, just, so if you're... Obviously, you're gonna idea is scaring people so they cling to the government for protection. And I mean, good example is the psychological effect of the serial killer is, even if you believe that there's one guy out there, or there's a guy out there who is picking a victim every 4 weeks or 2 months, whatever, following a certain pattern in these things. Is take an example of the Son of Sam case, where I think between 1976 and 1977, I believe there are 8 shootings, 5 fatalities. Now, how many normal homicides were there in New York City during that time frame? A lot more. Hundreds, right? but people are paralyzed by the idea of the Son of Sam case, and that gets all the press. Same thing with Ted Bundy. What's your odds of being killed by a serial killer? You have more chance of being struck by lightning or dying from a bee sting. That's human nature, and they know that. So this whole idea of a sort of a fiend, you know, marauding, you know, lurking in the alleys, waiting to pounce on some unsuspecting person. Well, that's emotion. That's Hollywood there speaking. That's what's scary. I mean, for the most part, you're not going to make a movie about people being struck by lightning. For the most part, being stung by a bee, for the most part. If it's about a bee, it's about a marauding swarm that kills hundreds of people. So it's going to be wildly exaggerated. So yeah, but nevertheless, it's car accidents and these things. It's slipping in the bathtub that present a much greater threat to our personal safety and health than the serial killer ever did, just statistically speaking. But again, pointing out some of these cases someone like a John Wayne Gacy, who was already a convicted sex offender when he was given a security clearance by the Secret Service to sit next to Rosalind Carter, the then First Lady of the United States. And the fact that he had bodies hidden in his basement, and the police went there and questioned him. And I believe in that particular case, this is in Dave McGowan's book, A Program to Kill, a ring that was belonged to one of the missing boys, the victims, the police identified that in his house. And nothing was done about it. He was kind of sort of allowed to proceed on, or at least go for a little while longer. And there's some theories about what maybe some figure like John Wayne Gacy might. These are assets, or they're doing certain things. Remember, when you almost like when the CIA uses cults, whether it's a Jim Jones cult or something, or to deal in criminal, whether it's a drug cartel or a cult, to deal in some sort of criminal activity that's in somehow supportive of a black operation, be that human trafficking and, you know, child prostitution, these things. The intelligence agencies are involved in these things. You're going to use people like John Wayne Gacy for these things in the meantime, and you might use them to get rid of people who witnesses in these things. So they're going to be out there doing their thing and killing and these things, and then finally their shelf life has expired and they shut them down. That's a practical explanation how an operation like this might go down. Again, I refer people to what's known about what occurred overseas, like in Paraguay with Dan Micheroni, who was a consultant to the CIA, I think a former Chicago police officer, FBI agent, who was used by the CIA. He's also a friend of Jim, an associate or friends of Jim Jones. But he went down and he trained Central and South American police departments on strategies of interrogation, torture, and these things. But his training methods involved going in and kidnapping innocent people off the street and torturing them and presumably killing them. Well, that sounds like a serial killer to me.
Yeah.
You know, so you can say, well, yeah, well, they'll do that in Paraguay or South Vietnam, but they're not going to do that here in good old US of A. Well, why not? And not to mention, and why it's being done. Again, it's a, practically speaking, a good example, like the Boston Strangler. You have media reports of this, of a serial killer strangling women. Now, what we come to know the serial killers are certain patterns in these things. Well, in the Boston Strangler, that the report actually said the pattern was there was no pattern. Well. What that really suggests is that there isn't one person doing it. These are disparate crimes that are being linked together by the media for sensationalist reasons, for whatever. But the reality is you can't go out, the pattern is no pattern. That's ridiculous. So it's one of these things where a narrative is spun. It's got no basis in reality, or very little basis in reality. and it's not what we think it is. It's there, and we, and it's, and in the meantime, the people are, you know, are scared, or the public is scared to death. It's a way you can get rid of good example, if you have in Boston, if you had an inconvenient girl, you could strangle her and then leave the body, and the police would say, well, this is the Boston Strangler. Well, there you go. Then that way it takes the police off your trail for investigating that murder. So there's many reasons why the police or a crime scene will be made to appear that the supposed serial killer did it. But the reality is, when you really examine the cases, there's very little evidence linking these disparate crimes, which again brings into question the entire narrative. And why? And again, the answer would be police trying to close the books, maybe cover up local corruption, which is the case in the Napa Valley in regards to the Zodiac Killer. There's a lot of drug running, a lot of police corruption, a lot of local sordid stories that are being covered up by this narrative. So that's how you have to ask yourself, what agenda is being pushed by this? And if you think the media is there, again, to boil everything down for you and wrap it in, boil it down, put it in a these stories in a way that's explicable, or you can understand, you can be an informed citizen, well then I think you're a little naive.
Well, yeah, and you're a little mind controlled. I just always try to advocate a kind of mental buoyancy. You don't willingly or unwillingly, subconsciously typically, allow your consciousness to be submerged into these emotions, hatred, fear. These things are what the goal is of the cultural anthropologists who have, weaponized their science and are attacking us. So, you mentioned how you can look at how police departments can basically manipulate information, by just sort of seeing all of these maybe and possibly connected kinds of murders as being, all coming from one individual, because that creates a more terrifying, reality or storyline for the citizen, makes mm-hmm. the citizen, more vulnerable to the desire to have more policing, right? But in that process, you have maintained a kind of mental buoyancy. You just haven't, run screaming out of the room in terror, asking for police protection. You're sitting there doing your analysis. And, one thing that I mention or I advocate is that you try to look at potential symbols. You're talking about actual facts and, things that can be connected based on police reports. But you have to kind of also look into the symbolism, because the secret society uses symbolism. Particularly cannibalism. I would shamelessly promote Caesar's Messiah as my book that so people, if you read it, you'll get a sense of a symbolic framework that someone who dislikes Christian might then apply in other areas. And that's why the one thing I would always, be wary of is any kind of cannibalism, because this is one of the key sort of New World Order, assault on Christianity kind of inside joke that goes on. For example, in the Pizzagate thing, you see, all of the pseudo cannibalism and in the Rothschild parties. I don't know if you've ever seen photographs of that. You have this pseudo cannibalism going on all over the place. Well,
Katy Perry videos.
Yeah, why is this funny? Well, it's funny from a certain perspective. And if you look at Jack the Ripper, one of the things that they released to the public was the fact that Jack was eating the kidneys of one of the individual cannibalism. This is just being done to terrorize. There's no reason to have this kind of information out. But this was,
of course, Silence of the Lambs was best picture, right?
I was just going to go there, right? That I think that in order to kind of maintain mental buoyancy, one good training is if you have to sit through something as sick as Silence of the Lambs, is just to try to analyze this character as to, well, not only how does Hannibal Lecter debase our existence by his actions in the movies, but what is the symbolism about? Why is he a cannibal? why is cannibalism, you know, part of the of you know, what role does it have in the whole production of the thing from the secret society? And the someone should try to be as familiar with sort of the symbolic side of the secret society as they can be, and to suspect things which are inexplicable, you know, like in the films, it's like with Hannibal Lecter, it's marvelous, you know, in the sense that, you know, it's because it's completely fictional, you can see that this is just all artificial, that the character is being created for some purpose. You know, when you get to like the Son of Sam, it's a little more difficult to parse out the crazy guy from, you know, whatever symbolism the OTO or whatever Masonic organization is running the guy is like manifesting in the murders. It's harder to parse out the real from the fantasy and the symbolism. But in the movies, you know, it's just, you can easily do this. And so, you know, I would advise not even watching them, but if you have to, this is how you can keep mental buoyancy, where you don't succumb to the, you know, the worst destruction that they have in mind for your soul. You know, you keep yourself thinking, you keep yourself analyzing, you're trying to find, you know, what is the reality to this, and then in doing so, you know, you're staying away from the, from the mind control.
Yeah, the issue of the question of the serial killer, the topic of the serial killer, Michael Hoffman, in his book Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, talks about it the serial killer as same thing with false flag terrorism. These things sort of, there's a chemical process that's in play here that is Masonic, and he talks touches on basically it's the degrading of society, and really the whole idea, the psychological effect, the mass psychological effect that the serial killer has in society only works in a society that is gradually degraded. So you have to work on degrading society, well, through the music and through the arts in the preceding decades. And then it gets to the point where society softened up, and then it can be baptized in this. But he writes, those who think ritual has no power to significantly alter behavior have not studied Catholicism closely. One of the most influential liturgical rites in the history of Christendom was the Tridentine Latin Mass. By requiring attendance at the Latin Mass every Sunday on pain of mortal sin, Rome converted almost the whole of Europe to Catholicism. The occult cryptocracy has much more refined inducement for attendance at their Masonic ritual. Spectacular optical. Few need to be induced to watch TV or read a sensational mass market picture magazine or newspaper. In fact, we pay to do so. Of course, many serial murders are nothing more than the work of a single individual acting out a graphic horror movie he saw, or responding to a powerful psychotic impulse for aggression and predation. Many other serial murders involve a cult protected by the U.S. government and the corporate media with strong ties to the police. These murders are actually intricately choreographed rituals performed first on a very intimate and secret scale among the initiates themselves in order to program them, and then on grand scale amplified incalculably by the electronic media. In the end, what we have is a highly symbolic ritual working broadcast to millions of people, a satanic inversion, a black mass where the pews are filled by the entire nation through which humanity is paganized, brutalized, and debased in this, the negredo phase of the alchemical process. And he says what this creates is a sort of a, what he calls the theater, or at least I don't think he coined it, it's a term called the theater of the cruel. And that's where sort of this brutality becomes more or less accepted by society. And we sort of acquiesce to it. And that's that alchemical process we talk about that he's referring to, is that's the effect of this, I guess, this character, the serial killer, and why he's so promoted.
Absolutely. I mean, I highly recommend Hoffman's work and the book Secret Society and Psychological Warfare, I believe it is. he gets into the symbolism, mm-hmm. you know, that, I mean, I remember he was talking about the Son of Sam, and he was relating the Son of Sam basically to the Wicker Man,
Yeah.
Right. Where you had the idea of the Wicker King, Wicked King Wicker, right, was one of the ways that the Son of Sam was signing, you know, documents. And Hoffman pointed out, I remember, that it was just a strange coincidence that the Wicker Man movie was then rerun at Manhattan theaters, right?
Yeah.
And so you can see the common, so it's sort of like the Kardashians, you know, the reality becomes the fantasy, which is indistinguishable from the pornography. I mean, it's just all just, the whole media is just one big lump of weaponized garbage. And it's coordinated, right? I mean, obviously it's coordinated. And so it all in combination, you know, is both a symbolic, right? It's, there's the symbolism of the Wicca, because this, of course, is cabal, right? That, I mean, you're into Aleister Crowley and the Golden Dawn. You know, this is where, how the cabal became, you know, reinvigorated in you know, in our culture in the 19th century and the 20th century. You know, with Aleister Crowley, and it's all coming from the Quattro Coronati. It's just amazing how these things are all connected, right? But this is, you know, the serial killer is clearly now in the Son of Sam. I mean, and I think Hoffman does just a great job in Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare of bringing this out, that, you know, you are absolutely in a world of both intentional cultural debasement and also symbolic representation of the secret society. Because these, you know, the witchcraft aspect of the Son of Sam and all of the idea of King Wicker, that's all the symbolic side. And then on you know, on the other side, you have the terrorist propaganda. And it's all coming, you know, in this case, this is another link that goes right back into the Quattro Coronati, because of Aleister Crowley being the individual, you know, who's actually, you know, getting the OTO going, you know, and this is why these ideas, this is where these ideas come from in the 20th century, is right out of this. Well, folks, I mean, this is the same, this Aleister Crowley, his Masonic passport is coming from the Quattro Coronati, the Freemason lodge that Charles Warren, the guy who erased the you know, Jack the Ripper's, you know, statement so no one would have it as evidence, the lodge he created, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how can this possibly, you know, this isn't something that's, you know, circumstantial. It is, you know, it's roughly organized. The society is able to take advantage of crazy people to plug them in, you know, and then all of the other things that you mentioned. They can take real killers and use the killing as, you know, as not only to eliminate people that they want to prune from, you know, from the world, but then they can use the murder as another way to terrorize. But they can set up their, you know, someone who is actually a for-profit murderer as someone who's a crazy murderer, because the for-profit murderer is not as scary as the run-amok, you know, killer. Yeah. And so that's how we're manipulated. We are then frightened and then, like, well, help us, you know, a noble police state.
Yeah, and one issue, I think, at least the mention to this, that we should consider is we talk about serial killers and vicious, you know, they ruthlessly kill people and these things. But we, of course, we live in a highly militarized society. We our nation is constantly at war, at one, you know, grade or another. We have you know, military operations in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, everywhere in the world. Yeah. We have drone strikes. Soldiers killing out, you know, search and destroy missions, whether it's in Vietnam or operations in Iraq, where they do raiding parties or in Afghanistan and these things. And in many cases, these soldiers are doing
I lost you, Tim.
Oh, can you hear me?
Are you back?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Sorry, I lost you just for a second.
Okay. Just in many cases, these soldiers, well, I mean, they'll if you're operating a drone, and you're blowing up a wedding party of 45 people because you think there might be one person in there who's of interest, are you a serial killer? It's because you're following orders. I was listening to a talk about Albert DeSalvo, the so-called Boston Strangler, and he was our serial rapist, and he had raped many women. And it turns out, he says, well, when he was in the military, he raped a couple hundred women. Since he was in the military in a wartime setting, nothing ever happened to him legally.
Yeah.
What does that say?
Yeah.
And not to mention, we talk about people willing to kill for the gratification of power. What about our leaders? What about our leaders who order these, who perpetrate these wars and they send these armies off to go fight in these wars and result in the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. Because it's an act of state, it's legitimate, it's not murder. Okay, fine. Take that perspective. But in Dave McGowan's Program to Kill, there is a epilogue, if I can find it, and he's writing about old Bokassa. This African potentate, Jean Bedel Bokassa, was a Western-supported third-world dictator, Central African Republic. Well, he was reported to have engaged in eating his enemies. He would have parties where he'd consume the flesh of his enemies. And he was a vicious killer, but he was also a politician. Let me find this thing. I'm doing on PDF here. Well, Bokassa finally falls from power, and he goes into exile. But after 8 years of exile, Bokassa returned to his homeland in 1987. Despite the fact that he had been sentenced to death in absentia, he was arrested, tried, convicted, and once again sentenced to death, but the sentence was shortly thereafter commuted to a 20-year prison sentence. In 1993, Bokassa was granted amnesty, and he walked away a free man, returning to his home village of Barengo. On November 3rd, 1996, he died of a heart attack at the age of 75 and was given an official state funeral befitting a former president. How then are we to remember Jean Bedel Bokassa? As a respected head of state or a cannibalistic serial killer? Or is there any difference?
Yeah, and good point. And the thing is that we have to remember that the meme that the world is a dangerous place, right, which is the justification for the wars, mm-hmm. Is developed partially through these isolated instances. So when you see serial killing, when you see mass murder in your own country, this normalizes violence.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, oh yeah, well, I guess everyone is violent, and therefore we just really do need a military that's everywhere in the world enslaving everybody, because that's the only way that we can be safe from terrorism, right?
Yeah, and here's another example, and that isn't direct, but I think one can extrapolate from this. Now, we've talked about in other shows how in the 1960s, the federal government funded black criminal gangs like the Blackstone Rangers.
Right.
In order to create mayhem, create violence, kill people, to create white flight in certain ethnic neighborhoods in the 1960s. So here we have an example of sort of this criminal black gang being used as a shock troops or a proxy force to go out and create crime. Ordinarily, we think the government is there to fight crime, protect our property and our rights, but it's doing the exact opposite in this case. It's out there secretly supporting criminal activity. How is that much different than, say, maybe letting a few killers out to create the serial killer thing in order to create fear? It's not much of a, at least I don't think, I think the strategy is the same. It's a strategy of tension. And also you can, of course, we talked about, of course, the strategy of tension in Europe with NATO and secret armies and Operation Gladio and northwards and these things. So we have that on record, government planning to perpetrate violence secretly against the American people and blaming it on other parties for the purpose, some political, geostrategic purpose, some social purpose. That's what white flight was all about and these things. So it's not, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think that perhaps they could resort to some of these tactics to achieve, you know, whatever.
Sure. Well, we're a post 9/11 world. Yeah. I mean, this should just be like axiomatic. You know, the government is a secret society run by one that is murderous.
I mean, look at drug dealing, right? I mean, I don't think. People now know that Air America, you know, CIA proprietary company, was flying heroin out of Southeast Asia to find its way ultimately into the United States. And in the process of doing this, it'd have to get in bed with warlords like in Laos, to criminal gangs like Meyer Lansky in the United States and Mexico, and to ship it in, and it's gonna be coming into Florida and Texas and California. Those areas, coincidentally, by the way, perhaps, that those are the three most prominent states when it comes to serial killers. So maybe a connection there, perhaps. But the idea is that, again, in the process of doing this, they're going to be, if not, you know, turning a blind eye to or winking and nodding or even supporting such things like human trafficking and drug trafficking, which involves all these rituals like MS-13 and this sort of these ritualistic crimes that these groups use to create group cohesion in these things, you know, whether it's the mafia or even MS-13. So these crimes are going to be supported. These crimes are going to be nurtured. What we knew what was going on in the Rampart scandal in LA Police Department, where police officers were moonlighting as security guards for drug gangs, and there's all types of we know about the involvement of the CIA and the LAPD in facilitating the importation of cocaine in LA in order to fund these wars in Central America. In the process of doing this, you're going to support all types of violent criminal activity. It's not too much of a stretch to suggest that maybe something is going on similar with the serial killer phenomenon.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I have a very good friend who is or was the chief psychiatrist of California's most secure prison. It's where they put people that are so violent, right, that they basically have to be under, you know, sedation or manacles 100% of the time. We should have Leo on the show. He's a fascinating guy. Because he has all this real background with people who are murderers, right? And I asked him once about this. I said, well, you know, what are they like? How are they able to function? And even though I wasn't specifically asking about serial killing, it comes out kind of the same way. What he said is that the real murderers cannot function socially. It's not like, you know, they can like have a regular job and then on the weekends go out and murder people. Mm-hmm. He said that, in fact, the people who are really murderous are so crazy that you can't even get near them physically, right? You have to manacle them. I mean, that's what he was saying, is that you know, manacles are massive drug sedation, which he didn't trust. He said that the really crazy, the ones who really do the murdering, you know, who are murderous over and over again, are too crazy to exist in society. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if a lot of these serial killers, in fact, are fake, because just based on what Leo told me from actual experience, that the really murderers are, you know, are literally schizophrenic and just cannot function in society. They would stick out like a sore thumb. So, you know, that's why like the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, McVeigh, you know, there's just the way to look at these people is artificial. Mm-hmm. You know, really, you need to look in what's in back of them, because these acts are so out of pattern of human sort of normal self-governance, right? We are social animals, and there's a kind of a restraint against exhibiting, you know, too much violence, right, among one another, that that you, I think that, you know, we, if we really spent time studying, we, that most of the serial killers would disappear into the secret society, or into basically just raw propaganda. You know, like the, some people say about Sandy Hook, that, you know, it never even happened, that this was just 100% media. And this is in line with your statement of 2 weeks ago about, you know, we get rid of the secret society. A lot of what we see are, you know, just the insane aspects of human nature in a dangerous world would all just disappear. These were all unreal elements that were just presented to us as human nature, when in fact they were just there to control us and to keep us from it, from using our real human nature to expose the secret society and get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the, yeah, that's like kind of like with was it Ole Damgaard, who did the research. He talks about how a lot of these incidents, these attacks, terrorist attacks, assassinations, are pretty much carried out by a small, like a traveling, like a troop of actors that go out and do these things. That these are the actual mechanics. So it's a very small group of people that are doing this. And he, like he says, if you get rid of this operation, you solve a lot of the world's problems.
Yeah. I mean, and this is really like a great thing. I mean, you know, because one, it creates a better way to deal with the phenomena as it is in the media, so you don't succumb to it and become terrorized. You keep thinking about it, you keep studying it, you keep trying to learn about it instead of, you know, being terrorized by it. And also because in doing so, you expose the real human nature, which is good. We're not, it isn't a dangerous world. It's that there are dangerous people who've gained control
of the
world.
And
they're the ones that make the world dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a dangerous world. It's a dangerous people who've gotten control of the world.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Making it dangerous.
Intentionally, yeah.
So. Okay, Joe. Think
Tim,
you covered it?
I really, yeah, enjoyed the discussion a lot. Can't wait to be back here next week.
Okay, great. Have a nice weekend then.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye. Talk to you soon. Bye.